From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. If you are consumed by a gnawing sense that this is the end of the world as we know it, then you should probably know that you're not alone. According to a Pew Research Center survey conducted in 2022, about 4 in 10 U.S. adults believe humanity is living in the end times. But it's also important to note that this isn't so different than any other time in our history. Large numbers of humans have always lived with a fear that the world will soon be coming to an end. And so, you know, chances are good this too shall pass. But what if it doesn't? What if the end really is nigh? Well, in that case, Athena Actippus has some advice for you. And contrary to what you might suspect, it's not all about guns and food storage. If you want to be ready for a coming dystopia, Actippus says you might want to start boning up on evolutionary psychology. You may wish to learn about brain science. You should probably study up on mathematical models of strategic interactions among rational agents. And you should also understand cooperation theory. Because when the time comes, Actippus says it's not just the strong who will survive. It's also the smart. Actippus is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Arizona State University, where she studies conflict and cooperation. She's also a bona fide expert on all things zombie-related, and while an actual zombie apocalypse may never come to pass, she believes there are plenty of lessons to be learned from studying survival in all sorts of likely and unlikely scenarios. Her new book is called A Field Guide to the Apocalypse. Athena Actippus, welcome.
Hey, so happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Hey, I wanted to start today with the Zombified podcast, which isn't really about zombies, but zombies are like this really great metaphor that you and your team use for other things that take over our bodies, our minds, our societies. And you started doing this podcast in mid-2019, and then lo and behold, just about a half year later, we're in a global pandemic.
Yeah. Well, I started the podcast because I was just so fascinated by like all of these things that take over our brains, from parasites to narcissists to like our adorable dogs.
Your first episode was about puppy dogs.
It was, yes. The puppy apocalypse, in fact. So we are influenceable by so many forces, whether they're social forces or biological forces. And we're not alone in the biological world in our ability to be zombified, our vulnerability to that. There are many, many examples from nature of organisms hijacking each other for their own ends. There's so many situations in the natural world where one entity takes over another entity that just absolutely fit the idea of zombies. Sort of extending that thinking, using this idea that really came from Richard Dawkins' work. He calls it the extended phenotype. It's this idea that our genes not only make our own bodies and guide our behavior, but they also are like our genes are under selection for the effect that they have on things outside of us. So everything from like beavers that build dams, right? And those like the dam building is built into their genetics, to parasites that have evolved to have a lot of their genes actually be about how to manipulate their hosts, right? Or humans who like a lot of our genes, presumably, genes that have to do with our ability to interact socially, have influence, like some of those are there because of the effect they allow us to have on our social environments. So it changes a little bit how we think about us as evolved beings, right? It's like, okay, we're not just evolved to be what we are within the boundaries of ourselves, but we're also evolved to have this effect on the things around us that, can almost seem like a little mystical or something, but it's not. It's like totally just based in, evolutionary biology and the science of how things, evolve to take each other over.
When did you start thinking about the world in this way? And it's, I mean, you get to this place, this idea of like zombification through kind of a morbid thing. You've been thinking about the end of the world for a long time. You wrote in your book that this is something that you started really ruminating on when you were a teenager.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was a teen, I was drawn in to this world of, you know, learning about, you know, ecology and all of the different disciplines really that you have to learn about to kind of understand what's going on with our world. And I had the feeling even at that young age that like the way that we were living our lives, especially in the market integrated West, like really wasn't going to be long-term sustainable, you know, for us as a society, or even really good for us as human beings, you know, because it's so different from how, you know, we evolved to be interacting with our natural environment and each other. And I left high school being like, you know, I want to learn all of the things about cooperation, about how people manage, you know, dilemmas where, you know, they have to figure out how to deal with, you know, limited resources. I want to understand how people make decisions over time, so sort of intertemporal choice, and engage with all of these disciplines and methods that will allow me to understand that. So, you know, I've done work in human psychology, experiments with, you know, human participants. I've done a lot of computational modeling, field work, like I use like many, many different methods to try to kind of triangulate on these and just like bring like all of the different perspectives in. And that's kind of like that's what I did. And I started when I was in college, but like, I do kind of use like the apocalypse in a, you know, sometimes in a somewhat tongue in cheek way. And other times, like when I say apocalypse, I actually mean like very much in like the Greek sense. The ancient, you know, Greek translation of apocalypse isn't the end of the world. It's like a revealing of the underlying nature of things. And so, you know, any event that like lets you see from a different perspective what the landscape is of the risks that we're facing, I think, you know, that's an apocalypse as opposed to the true end of all that we know.
A lot of people use apocalypse in this way, right? There's this whole thinking about apocalypse, which is, well, there's that sort of Judeo-Christian way, which is like everything ends. This is the apocalypse. But then there's this idea of a post-apocalypse, which is sort of counterintuitive, because if everything is ended, how can there be a post? But, you know, we have all this post-apocalyptic fiction. And this idea is that some of us, many of us, are going to still be around. A lot of this book is about that idea. And here it's maybe important to make this distinction that this is actually a very, very likely scenario. At any given time in human history, you've written about 20 to 30% of all people who have died as a result of some apocalyptic event. Talk about that.
Yeah. So a colleague of mine, Michael Gervin, he's done some very interesting mathematical modeling where he basically like, you know, looks at, you know, what are the demographic patterns that you see in small scale societies. And then he used that mathematical modeling to sort of back calculate like what the likelihood is that for our ancestors, that they would have died in some sort of a catastrophic event, whether it's like a famine, a pandemic, a war, natural disaster, et cetera. And, you know, based on our best guess about the numbers, that's between 20 and 25%. So, you know, if you imagine like your family and like your closest friends, like maybe the 30 or 40 people who are closest to you, that like 8 to 10 of them would have died of, you know, some sort of catastrophic event in your lifetime, like that's huge. So, yeah, we have been dealing with catastrophes and disasters from our earliest beginnings, you know, from our best guesses, you know, based on demographic, you know, the demography and the anthropology that that people have been doing in this area.
And then there's this other way of looking at this, which is that the rate of upheaval that is being experienced across our societies right now suggests that in many ways we're actually living in an apocalyptic time.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of people who even talk about the before times, right? Like before COVID, you know, before we were in lockdown. And, you know, and that was, you know, comparatively a relatively mild pandemic compared to other pandemics that we've experienced in human history. But it was quite apocalyptic for many of us, certainly for people who live in the West and have, you know, relatively like secure lives. It's probably the most apocalyptic thing that many of us have experienced. So I think that's another important sort of perspective to keep in mind. Like the apocalypse is not just like the end of all of civilization and life, you know, human life on Earth, but you can also kind of have local apocalypses, and you can have places where people are more insulated, right, from disasters and threats, and places where people are more vulnerable.
And it wouldn't be as attractive, you know, on the bookstore shelves, but you could call this book something like How to Survive Really, Really Crappy Times.
Yeah. I could call it, you know, How to Survive Not Being Able to Find Your Keys When It's Raining, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of...
Well, and you jest there, but that's, I mean, there's a very strong element of psychology here, which is like, this is about your bad day, like, picture your worst day. This is about your worst day and how to get over that and through that.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole second chapter is, you know, your brain on the apocalypse. And that's purposeful because, like, you know, you need to understand how you process information, how we deal with, you know, figuring out if something is or isn't a threat, how we learn and communicate, and all of those things that, you know, are built into our human psychology are essential, not just because, you know, there are many ways that we're really actually adapted for apocalyptic conditions, that, you know, we've got it. Like we know how to deal with uncertainty. We can communicate, we can cooperate, we can, you know, come up with novel solutions. Like we have a lot of skills that are really relevant for surviving challenging times.
Yeah, you've written that, like, because we evolved through plagues and natural disasters and wars and famines and all these really horrible little apocalypses, we've sort of evolved to be apocalyptic badasses.
Yeah, much more so than many of us think. And, you know, like once you kind of start like on your journey of like, oh, well, you know, what if I try like managing my risk a little bit in this domain by like, you know, maybe having a little kit in my hiking backpack if things go wrong, or a kit in my car, like, you know, and you realize like, oh, okay, like, you know, it actually feels really, really good and very natural to be ready for the kinds of disasters that you might experience in a day-to-day way. And we also were very, very social, very cooperative. And during apocalyptic times, when people are in need and things go wrong and things are chaotic and uncertain and uncontrollable, what you see is people cooperating much more. That is the norm. And that's what we saw. You know, I'm the co-director of this huge project, the Human Generosity Project, where we looked, we, you know, went to the field, you know, more than a dozen societies, looked at how people help each other in times of need during catastrophes and other challenges. And we saw people help each other. In fact, they help each other more, not less, when things get bad. You know, for most situations in our evolutionary history, when there was hardship, really, you know, what you see, or what is the most likely scenario based on our best guess, right, from looking at hunter-gatherers and pastoralist small-scale societies that people were living in a way that was more similar to our ancestors, what you see is more cooperation, not less.
And this is something that we can take stock in. In fact, it relates back to that really famous thing that Fred Rogers said, right, about disasters, like when things are going badly, look for the helpers, because they'll be there. They're always there.
Yeah. In fact, that's, you know, for most people, that is the instinct. When things go wrong, like, put on your own oxygen mask first and then look around and see if somebody else needs help.
And then for personal individual survival, we actually need a lot less than we might think we need. You've written, we need shelter, we need water, we need warmth, we need food. And sort of anything above and beyond that is icing.
Yep, that is icing. And, you know, yeah, it can be, you know, awesome to have some extras. But, you know, I think a lot of people, honestly, myself included, have a hard time getting started with being prepared because it feels overwhelming to be like, well, how can I be ready for every kind of disaster? And, you know, and then maybe I'll miss something and then that'll be the reason that I'll die. But you can just start with, you know, the basics, making sure that you have a little kit where you have some some layers or an emergency blanket to keep yourself warm, some matches so you could start a fire if you need to, some, you know, some water, some snacks in there. And, you know, it's you don't need that much to get started. So
your book totally did this to me. I was reading your book and then I had this old pair of gym shorts that had gotten a hole in them and I could no longer, you know, use with all decency to the rest of the world. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm going to cut these up so that I can use them as rags. And I was cutting them up. And as I was doing, I just very narrowly avoided my index finger with the scissors. And then I thought, like, gosh darn it, Matthew, if you were in the zombie apocalypse right now, that really would be bad.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, I guess you fully experienced how sometimes when you're trying to manage your vulnerabilities, you can also create more, which is definitely something to be aware of.
Besides these basic survival imperatives, there's also this idea that you've written about like thriving in these times. And that's really about not too many more things, kind of like five. You need to have a way to satiate your curiosity. You need to be able to maintain your humor, have some entertainment, engage in storytelling, which is the thing that I always say is the thing that separates us from all of the other species on this planet, as far as we know. And then having the capacity to socialize. So if you could do those things, if you can get those survival imperatives taken care of, and then these sort of characteristics of a thriving life, even in really bad times, you can do okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, a lot of what makes my book different from other sort of apocalypse survival guides is it's really a book about the other side of this, which is both, you know, surviving and then also thriving and the kinds of things that you need to really like go from a sort of narrow mindset about, you know, how to deal with risks and threats to a more open and like an approach where there's like the possibility for not just dealing with the things as they're happening, but also being proactive, you know, about managing your own risk and working together with others to do something about the sort of broader context that we're in. You need these things that like nobody typically talks about in the typical discussions about prepping, right?
So at prepper.com, there's not a whole lot of conversations about like mindset.
No, there aren't. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, even in those communities, though, like people do recognize like, well, you know, being positive, having grit, like things like that. But there's a whole other side, which is about being able to be imaginative, being able to really like find your own like curiosity and playfulness and engage that so that you can really learn about the threats that are out there in a way that doesn't feel intimidating. So I think
like you've suggested that one of the things that people should consider having in their prepping portfolio is a ukulele.
Yeah, I pretty much don't go anywhere without a musical instrument of some sort, honestly. There are so many ways that like having some creative outlet, you know, maybe for you, it's not music. Maybe it's creative writing. Maybe you like to write stories or you like to paint or, you know, whatever that is, like having something that keeps you in an open mindset and makes it possible for you to sort of not get shut down by fear is just essential. And it's also a great way to connect to other people. You know, those social relationships are really essential, you know, in our, you know, survival toolkit. So,
okay, but still, I mean, like, man cannot live by psychology alone. The better prepared we are to meet those first few needs, the better off we're going to be to engage in those other things, right? So, talk to me about your prepper game. What do you got in your bunker?
What do I got? Well, so I have a range of sort of, you know, items that go from like my go bag, which I've never actually had to use. There were a few days 2 summers ago when it was sitting on my kitchen table because there were wildfires in Flagstaff and I was living up there at the time. And I was on the precipice of evacuating for a few days. So I was just like, I had it there and ready to go. I think if I didn't have a go bag packed, it would have felt more scary, like if I did have to actually engage that.
Okay, tell me, so you've got your go bag. What else do you like, for you personally, what makes you feel better and more prepared when we're talking about those physical things? We'll get deeper into the psychological things.
Yeah,
again,
so I've got the go bag, and then there's the shelter in place kit. So that's basically so that you can stay home for 72 hours if you need to, right? So if everybody had had one of those when the pandemic hit, we would have been in such a better situation, because there, you know, everybody would have just been able to stay home. There wouldn't have been worries about, you know, getting food and water to people who don't have them, right? So there was a whole humanitarian crisis that was a sort of knock-on consequence of sort of, you know, declaring that everybody had to stay home and everything shut down. So shelter in place kit, super important. It's actually extremely altruistic to have a shelter in place kit yourself and to help your neighbors and network and more vulnerable people around you who can't afford that, get all that set up, because that makes us more resilient as a society to disasters. So
that means other people don't have to take risks in order to help you.
That exactly.
And then you suggested that a big part of prepping isn't, you know, just what you have in your basement. It's not just your go pack or your 72-hour kit. It's what you've got in your head. So talk to me about the most important skills and knowledge someone should have to survive and thrive in a post-apocalyptic world.
I think, you know, there's curiosity, humor, entertainment, storytelling, socializing, super, super important. Also, you know, being very open to learning from multiple perspectives, not kind of getting stuck in an information loop where you're, you know, maybe seeing things as threats that if you look from another perspective, you wouldn't see them as threats. And I would say that probably the most important thing is, you know, incorporating sort of readiness for, you know, various challenges and hazards into your day-to-day life as well. And in fact, this is a really great place to start. If you're like, oh, I don't really feel like I can yet do the go bag, you can start with putting together your car kit, right? So that, you know, if you have an issue with your car or you get into an accident, you have things to keep yourself and your family safer. And doing those kinds of things, you know, helps it feel less intimidating to start being prepared for the bigger risks as well. And it makes us feel sort of more secure that, like, oh, we can go out into the world and, you know, learn about the place that, you know, we live in, that we can have some adventures where things that are unexpected might happen and deal with them successfully. So I think, you know, building that, I call it the apocalypse casual lifestyle. You know, you're just kind of like, you're ready for all the routine things that might go wrong, but, you know, also, like, you're wearing sensible shoes so that, like, if you did need to break into a run, you could do that in the event of a real emergency.
You are pretty chill about the end of the world as we know it, but I think everybody worries about something. So what's the thing that you really don't feel chill about?
It's a good question. The thing that terrifies me the most, honestly, is a sort of cluster apocalypse. Which is, you know, when you don't just have sort of one thing happening, like a pandemic, for example, where, you know, that's like, okay, that's the thing that's happening. But you have pandemic, and then that leads to knock-on effects and reverberating effects throughout. You know, and we saw some of that to a certain degree with COVID. But with a more severe pandemic, you know, like the whole healthcare system could be stretched to the point where it can't function. And having this sort of this breakdown of a lot of the infrastructure that we're used to having working, you have this fails, and then that causes this thing to fail, which then makes this thing more vulnerable, and then that feeds back on this thing, right? A sort of complex systems apocalypse. So I would say that's the thing that, you know, I'm most worried about. And that sort of speaks to maybe the need for, like, considering, like, more broadly, like, you know, the resilience of a lot of our economic and, you know, political and social services. And, you know, are there ways to make them more sort of modular and resilient? And, you know, are there things that we can learn maybe also from small scale societies about, like, how to keep certain things simpler so that you have fewer reverberating effects?
That's Athena Ektipis. She's an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Arizona State University, where she studies human conflict and cooperation. And her new book is called A Field Guide to the Apocalypse. Athena Ektipis, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. Support our work. Go on over to donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.